ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
and energy. I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition. Those two.
With Larissa Behrendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
Obviously, you know, you hope that they enjoy your writing. That's straightforward. I think more importantly is that what I would really hope is that they do, as you alluded to, I hope that they value the lives of the characters in this collection. And I do hope it helps people think and reflect about what sort of society we live in and possibly what sort of society we want to live in, whether it be about violence against women, whether it be about racism against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, or just the mistreatment of disadvantaged people generally.
Pictures of You, the best of acclaimed writer Tony Burch's short fiction, and Defending the Defenceless, a powerful exploration of Indigenous self-determination within the legal system.
I really just wanted to try and highlight, you know, a lot of our people are coming from really bad situations due to public policy around the stolen generations and then just the ongoing tough on crime. And I think it sort of captures that everyone who works in there and has gone through there has really strived to really fight for our people's rights. And just the creation of the Aboriginal Legal Services, Larissa, is that it didn't come out of a Royal Commission. It didn't come out of some quasi government pilot program. It came because Indigenous people saw their need, that they needed to have a service to look after and defend our people. And I think that really underpins the title.
This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Behrendt. Great writers have the ability to change our minds, make us think deeply about life, and teach us lessons along the way. First Nations writer and historian Tony Burch is one such writer. He grew up in the suburb of Fitzroy in Melbourne in the 1960s. His short stories are inspired by his upbringing and his observations on family and community, and now they've been gathered in his latest book, Pictures of You. It reinforces his reputation as a fierce and compelling storyteller. It was also a reminder to me of why he is one of my favourite writers. Tony Burch joins me via our Melbourne studio to talk to me about his beautifully written collection.
Well, it was difficult. I had probably over 100 stories to choose from, and they were stories that, you know, I really have a great affection for. I think that I did think of themes. So there were particular themes around family, particular themes around race, particular themes around, I suppose, loss and yearning. But having said that, it was a bit like doing a mixtape or best of. So I really could have put twice as many stories in. And I know that one of my daughters, Siobhan, who was involved in the launch, she was disappointed that her two favourite stories were not included. Had she spoken to me beforehand, I would have done what she said. But it was a matter of trying to find range. Obviously, there are some gritty stories, particularly dealing with family violence. But I wanted to, I suppose, not counterpose those, but just to sit those alongside some much quieter stories. So a story like Paper Moon, which is one of my favourite stories that I've ever written, is a very quiet story. So I wanted to make sure a story like that was in there, sitting alongside, you know, a story like The Butcher's Wife.
Well, I have to say Paper Moon is one of my favourites, so I did not suffer from feeling left out. But I think one of the wonderful things about the book, especially for somebody like me who's followed your work and had all the collections, is there are also stories that come from other places. So there are some new stories that I wasn't familiar with, but a lot of them felt like old friends. And in reading the book, I guess one of the things that really comes through, and I think this has been an observation not just in your short stories but through your novels as well, is the way in which you explore ordinary lives with such deep compassion and complexity. The characters are always so rich. How do you find them and make them so compelling with that mix of flaws and resilience?
I just ask people to write in with suggestions. No. I think it's a combination, Larissa, so that there would be aspects of real-life people that I've met. So another favourite story of mine, Bobby Moses, which is about an old Aboriginal fella who goes onto his own country for the first time in his life, having been a member of the Stolen Generations. His voice is, and his demeanour and his level of cheekiness with the local copper, clearly that was channeling Jackie Charles. Jackie was alive at the time, and I spent a lot of time with Jackie around Fitzroy, and he was a great mentor of mine, but also incredibly mischievous. So the combination of wisdom and sort of boyish charm is very important in that story. Obviously, the character is not Jackie. It's using that great strength of Jackie Charles to channel that into a fictional character. And I think I do that a lot, so that particularly with teenagers, so that, you know, as you know, I have five adult children, but they were young people once. And my four daughters in particular, very sort of sassy, tough women. And I've increasingly written young female protagonists, teenage girls who reflect my observations of my own daughters. And then sometimes, Larissa, it's just literally picking up a snippet of information that I might overhear or that I might read about. And I don't say that that's the story, but there was something captured in some unusual moments that I witness, and I tend to hold those, and often they turn into stories. So, yeah, typically I think with a writer, and particularly a short story writer, you're just sort of like a bit of a bower bird, and you pick up stuff. And I think that the thing about writing that's important here, it's not about how well you write technically. It's, I think, about how you observe the world. And I think that's what can distinguish one writer from another, your ability to have a quite original insight into what it is you see in the world and then turn that into words and story.
It does feel like that when one reads your work, but I think the thing that I'm always struck by is, you know, of course, having read your novels, but also your short stories, is the ability to find those vignettes. And I'm often reminded, it's probably misattributed, but the quote from Mark Twain, where he said, I was going to write a short story, but I didn't have the time, so I wrote a novel, that there actually is a greater skill in being able to take that moment, that vignette, and yet give us a snapshot into a whole person's life, a whole person's character, a whole person's voice. And it's something that, you know, I think you've been able to really do in your work.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that to a novelist. They get annoyed at that.
I'm sure they would.
I don't know if it's harder, but it is a very different skill. So that it is about economy, but you know, it's interesting that Twain quote, if you take the aspect of it, he didn't have time. It is also the fact that writers that I've taught and some novelists that I know, they actually can't hold a story in 10 or 12 or 20 pages. They have to expand, and that's fine. And that shows that inherently they're a novelist. And I've taught students who are writing short stories for a short story subject, and I can tell that this is a young or would-be novelist at work. So it is a skill to able to know that what you have is enough. And that what you're carrying in your hands, the story you're carrying, it doesn't have to be big. And I actually sort of think you have to know that before you start writing that individual piece. And I tend to know that. In other words, I tend to know an idea that I've got, is this a short story or is this a novel? And occasionally, if it's a poem.
You work across all those genres, but I think one thing that comes through in all your work is you have these very rich characters and very rich story worlds, and your writing is very much about that character-driven approach. But you don't shy away from themes like domestic violence. You don't shy away from issues around race and discrimination and those harsh impacts. In fact, you often have characters that are really living on the margins and often would lack social visibility. So I wonder how you approach the craft of really having something important structurally to say, about the structures of society in your work, but keeping it so character-driven.
Well, I think that if you take family violence, I don't know if my circumstances are peculiar, but I've never thought that writing about family violence is a taboo area or that it's more difficult. I think there is a particular responsibility. I think particularly the way you portray female characters, if you're writing a story about family violence, because even though they're women who are obviously suffering violence at the hands of men, I'm at pains to give qualities of strength, of agency and determination to women because they reflect the lives of women that I grew up with. So, yes, not a secret to revealing a secret to say I came out of a house of quite horrific family violence and a suburb where I saw a lot of violence as a kid. I'm very fortunate that my mother has been a person who would never not speak about family violence. In other words, she would never be silent. She would never agree to not expose a man who had been violent towards a woman. So when I grew up in my family, not in the wider culture, speaking about violence was acceptable and almost required. When I write a story about family violence, I feel strangely, I know the word mightn't seem right, I feel comfortable with the writing. I am, though, at pains to think and consider how I deal with that issue, how my readers may understand that issue. And again, the portrayal of women in particular, I mean, I have to admit I'm not someone who thinks of the male characters in my stories around violence who have to be more rounded. You know, they're poets by the day and wife beaters by the night or something. I tend to think that the male characters in my fiction reflect the men that I knew, that they are largely men who are really problematic and men that I didn't like growing up around.
I have to say, as a female reader, I've always been struck by your ability to write strong female characters, and I often identify with them. There are many through this collection, but I'm also thinking of books of yours like The White Girl. And there is something, it's more than just the stoic resilience of women. There is real agency there, and I think that's what brings them alive.
Yeah, and I think that the two reasons for that are I'm surrounded by those sort of women all my life. So I grew up amongst my mother and grandmother primarily, and I two sisters who are, you know, they could stop a train, my sisters. And I have four, as I said, four daughters who are all loving but, you know, quite assertive and strong women. So I've always been in a life of women. And I suppose in myself that, you know, it's not a form of what you might call androgynous writing, but as a child I was always quizzical about issues of gender and my own identity as a male, in the sense that not in a sense of sexuality, but in a sense of, again, of culture and psychologically. So when I saw men around me acting with violence towards women when I was a kid, I remember, as odd as it might sound to some people, when I was about 5 or 6, I wished I was one of my sisters. I didn't want to grow up to be a man. I thought I would rather grow up to be a woman because women don't act the way that men do. So I was fascinated by the contradiction of women primarily suffering violence, but the fact that women didn't, in my case or in our community, exhibit tendencies of violence, I thought, oh, it would be better to be a woman than a man.
Well, that does give some insight into why you capture those characters so well. I asked you earlier about what it was like or how you approach putting the collection together, but in terms of looking back over the enormous body of work that you'd done, what were your reflections on that? And did you see, I guess, a personal evolution in your skills as a writer or your development as a writer?
It's interesting because if I look at my first collection, Shadowboxing, and we chose stories from that, I think if I go back over that, there are things that I would do differently, and I think that there are ways that I've improved as a writer, but even still, the essence of those stories I really love. I'm still proud of those stories. So, yes, you do develop and you should get better, but you have to be careful that you don't get worse. So By that I mean it's good to remember what it is you started doing, and what you continue to do is essentially, yeah, I'm a relatively direct writer. People might say that I write sparse prose, or that's a bit hackneyed and cliched, but I think the worst thing you could do is start to think you're great, or start to think you're, you know, now an accomplished writer, and start to write in ways that are a wanky, basically. So I think that if you look at the later novels of older male writers who have been in the game for a long time, there's a tendency to think that maybe they should have gone out a bit earlier. And I have a belief that it's a bit like being an aging football player. You'd be better off leaving when you had a good season than if you got dropped to the reserves the next year.
Well, I hope you're not thinking of retiring in that way. In fact, one of the things I'd just say off the back of what you've said there, I thought one of the things that was really impressive about seeing the collection was the consistency of quality through it. But also, I guess, looking at where you might be going next now that you've put this collection of past writings together, I was wondering if you could share with us the sorts of things that are interesting you now in terms of things that you're being drawn to write about.
I can give you a scoop, Larissa.
I love a scoop.
Yeah, you're going early. So I've got a novel that I've finished called You Miss My Heart. It's about an Aboriginal boy, Lee, a 14-year-old boy, who gets sucked into the welfare system, where he is taken from his mother into a, what you might call a welfare home. But from there, he gets drawn into the juvenile justice system, and what should have been a short-term stay away from his mother amounts to a 4-year absence. And in that time, he loses contact with his younger brother, Billy. He loses contact with his mother, Beryl. And when he comes out of an adult prison at 18, it's a search for him to try and reunite himself with his mother and younger brother. So it's a very character-driven novel around the relationship between two young brothers, very loving relationship. But it's also a book about the impacts of removals on women, and the disregard shown to Aboriginal mothers. And it's about the hypocrisies of the welfare system. But again, it's very character and story driven, and I'm really pleased with the novel. It's not being released until February next year, so it'll be out in February next year. And I'm subsequently now working on the beginnings of what I'm calling a very quiet project. So I'm sort of thinking a novella-length work just about a grandfather and a granddaughter, and that would probably be something that I'd finish around the end of this year, but obviously that wouldn't come out until 28, I think.
Well, we've already got dates in the Speaking Out diary to have you back on to talk about both of those things. Now, I've said lots of great things about this book because I really loved it. And as you know, I'm a huge fan of your writing. But I wonder if you might give us a reading, and then everyone listening to our conversation will know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I'll just read a little bit from Bobby Moses.
Oh, I love this story. I love this character.
I loved writing it. This is just a short page. The other character mentioned is Hunter. Hunter's a policeman who has picked up Bobby on the side of the road. So let's go with that. For the next half hour, Hunter listened to the rain and thunder as he tried composing a poem to text back to Dolores. Lightning bolts momentarily lit the sky. When the rain finally eased, he again wound down his window. The sight of the motionless shadow of the old man leaning against a tree frightened Hunter. Initially, it looked like Bobby Moses' body was hanging from a limb. Hunter jumped out of the car and walked towards the tree. Bobby was soaking wet. His dark suit clung to his frame, and he was holding his shoes in one hand. His feet were covered in mud, twigs, and eucalypt leaves. "Where did you get to?" Hunter asked. "You must be crazy, turning around the rain in bare feet." "Oh, I went crazy a long time ago, years back," Bobby laughed. "I'll tell you something that sent me crazy," he added, without any prompting from the police officer. when I got hold of my government file, I read that after I'd been taken from my mummy and put in the home, white people came to look at me with the thought of taking for their own, and all of them rejected me. They knocked me back. Bobby laughed louder. Think how that would send you crazy, he said. These bastards take you from your own people, claiming that your own mum is no good, and then none of them righteous bastards want you anyway. Bobby walked past Hunter. Yep, he said, opening the passenger door. Reading that sent me crazy for a year or more.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Just finally, what are you hoping people will take from this collection?
Well, I think that obviously you hope that they enjoy your writing. That's straightforward. I think more importantly is that what I would really hope is that they do, as you alluded to, I hope that they value the lives of the characters in this collection, and I do hope it helps people think and reflect about what sort of society we live in and possibly what sort of society we want to live in, whether it be about violence against women, whether it be about racism against Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, or just the mistreatment of disadvantaged people generally. I'm writing stories that challenge the notion that Australia is anything like a so-called lucky country, anything like a country of the fair go, which it's neither of those, and recent years has shown to be the case, so that I hope people feel that those around us who are less fortunate and those around us who treat the less fortunate in a negative way, that we need to stand up around those issues and we need to support people who are marginalised. And people like me, you know, I'm in a position of relative power, so I have a good job, I have a good salary, I can be on the radio with Larissa Barrant, that I use that opportunity to provide a voice where I can for those people through my characters.
I'm sure for people like me who are familiar with your work, this will, as it was for me, be a wonderful kind of reminisce about some of the things and you've written about before, the characters you've introduced us to and those thematics through your work. And I guess for people who are not so familiar with your work, it's a great way into some of your writing and directs them to where they can find more. Tony Virch, thank you so much for your words, for your voice, for your insights and for spending some time with us on Speaking Out.
Oh, Larissa, thank you very much. It's a privilege to be on.
That was writer and historian Tony Birch speaking about his new book, Pictures of You. It's a powerful collection of short stories that transform small moments into compelling narratives.
I'm full of the anger. I've cried all the tears out. Not only angry at you, I'm angry at me. Where did my spine go? I've always had a backbone, but I let you walk all over me, and worse, I was happy, and I tried to sort through your mind, but I'm done. Gonna miss me loving you. I've struggled to trust before, but now I will even. tell me you want to stay with me, but if you did, you'd be as sad as if you left me. Doesn't matter that you're sorry, and you say you never wanna hurt me. Good intentions don't change reality and consequences. And I tried to sort through your mind, but I'm done convincing you. And at the end of the day, when you take it all away, you're gonna miss me loving you. Yeah, you're gonna miss me loving you.
That's Melbourne-based Wiradjuri artist Ruby May with her song Sort Through Your Mind. It's taken from her most recent album Baby, which explores themes of love, resilience and self-discovery.
You're listening to Speaking Out.
It just comes down to showing, sharing, you know, respecting
the world from an Indigenous perspective on ABC Radio.
Earlier on the show, we talked with writer Tony Burch about how small observations and moments have the power to become powerful stories to learn from. Professor Eddie Cabillo had one of those moments in a courtroom 15 years ago that changed the trajectory of his career. His new book, Defending the Defenceless, explores what it's like practicing as a lawyer while also being a proud Aboriginal man. It critiques the systems while also giving us solutions that are self-determined and led by First Nations legal services. You might remember from my earlier conversations with Eddie that he was one of my PhD students, and you'll see why PhD supervision is the thing I love most, find the most rewarding about being in academia.
Look, I think initially my thesis was from an Indigenous standpoint, so, and storytelling. So I think it was a lot more easier than the normal PhD to change across, but still it had a lot of, way to go to get it into a type of book form. And, there was a lot of to and froing with the publisher. So, a lot of editing here and there, and, finally got something that we agreed upon, and here we are.
It's always great to see the sort of dense academic parts of a thesis, like the methodology and the literature review, taken out. And as you say, one of the really strong things about your thesis that is the core of this book was that you came at it, you mentioned your standpoint, but you had strong lived experience in the space that you then approach from an academic perspective. So how did you approach sort of balancing your personal reflections and experience with looking at what other people had experienced, what had been written, and other perspectives?
Yeah, look, I just come out of a working on the Royal Commission in the Northern Territory, and it was really taxing on myself and obviously others that worked there. And on my way home, I'd been thinking about it and just thought about how the ALS, the Aboriginal Legal Services, the work that they'd done over that 18 months working on the Royal Commission, and how we work with them closely to get into our communities and build the trust. And I just thought that really gets lost on the journey when we're dealing with the justice space in Australia. And I just thought I really wanted to try and talk about that side of things and get that across. No one sort of thinks about that. And also, what I really struggled with was that Aboriginal legal services are sort of lumped with the whole of Indigenous justice. They get lobbed with it and responsible for everything that goes on with Indigenous people in the justice system. And really, that's really unfair, right? And the realities are that they're only a real small component of the justice system, but everyone sort of lobs it into their basket as fully responsible for that space. And it was just something I really wanted to try and speak about from my perspective, someone who was a board member, then a chair of an Aboriginal legal service, then worked at the legal service across the country, and then running the national body, and just seeing it from the courtrooms right through public policy and how they continuously get a bad go from everyone, including our own people, who, you know, when you're in trouble with the justice system, you're not really thinking straight, and we're not really in the right frame of mind, and also not understanding what the parameters are for the delivery of service for the Aboriginal legal services. And so just thought I'd try and show some respect on their history and where they came from and the services that they provide. And under the conditions that they currently work under, you know, and they're fairly hostile. I mean, the last time I worked at the national body, the incumbent government at the time was a Liberal government, and they were going to reduce our funding across the country is 75%. And so, you know, those are some of the conditions that Aboriginal legal services are fighting outside of the courtroom and outside of our communities.
I want to dig into some of your core ideas, but before I do, I love the title of the book, Defending the Defenceless, and I wonder if you could share a little bit about how you landed on that title and what it means to you.
I think, you know, like, I became a board member at a fairly young age, and what I saw our organisations doing really empowered me to think about my possibilities of becoming a lawyer. And I had kids at a very young age, and higher ed wasn't something that I was striving to do, having kids such at a young age. But just being on the board and watching our people at every level, you know, our field officers, you know, our office staff, and everyone just working really tirelessly to get really great outcomes for our people. And, you know, coming from the Northern Territory, where 85% of the prison population has been our people, and the policies that and legislations that really target our people, really brought home to me that this organisation was one of the only ones that was really trying to defend our people. And I really just wanted to try and highlight, you know, a lot of our people are coming from really bad situations due to public policy around the stolen generations and then just the ongoing tough on crime. And I think it sort of captures that everyone who works in there and has gone through there has really strive to really fight for our people's rights, and just the creation of the Aboriginal Legal Services, Larissa, is that it didn't come out of a Royal Commission. It didn't come out of some quasi government pilot program. It came because Indigenous people saw their need, that they needed to have a service to look after and defend our people, and I think that really underpins the title.
I just want to follow up on that in a way, because I think one of the things that you're very good at doing, and partly because you've got such a depth of understanding, having been a part of those services from your various roles within them, from your perspective in what you've seen, you talk about the unique way they were created and also the passion that people have when they work within the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander legal services. But what else have been the essential ingredients that make them so culturally and legally effective? Why are they so important to our communities in the way they operate today?
Well, I think that history plays a big part of it, Larissa. I think that coming from the grassroots of, you know, of Redfern and really, you know, Gary Foley talks in the interviews that I've had with him that, you know, after the referendum, you had 30,000 people just converge on Redfern, and then all the issues arise with, you know, the police and governments and the way that they started to, you know, handle our people just really drove them to develop these this service, which in Gary's words, that, you know, it was the blackfellas that that really dictated how the service provision was provided. And it really was about community, and the community really, you know, pushed pressure on that services to make sure that it really delivered services that was suitable and compatible to the community. And I think that underpins the whole services when it delivers. And, you know, I've worked across everywhere in this country, and people who come through those services are inducted into that culture and that those values. You know, it's like a family, and including non-Indigenous people, right? And you cannot see these people for 20 years and you see them again, and it's like that they've are part of the family because of the way we work closely together, working for our people, you know, in our communities. And that really helps shape them, but also shapes the culture within our organizations in how we deliver our services to our people, you know. And that really comes to, I now catch up with other Indigenous people across the country that worked in ALSs, and it's like we're family, and I think that's the culture that permeates in these places, and that then goes back into the workplace.
You mentioned earlier about some of the pressures, external pressures that are put on the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander legal services in relation to perhaps the funding cuts that often come through continually. And of course, the irony is, of course, the First Nations people are the most overrepresented in that system, so the need's the greatest. From your work, the sort of research you've done, your experience, what are the sorts of things that need to happen to ensure that our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander legal services are able to perform at the level that the community needs them to?
Yeah, good question. Look, we've had so many Royal Commissions, coronials, you know, funding reviews that have so many recommendations that would go a long way in assisting that. But I think it's a actual cultural change in Australia. And I think we're seeing it at the moment at its fullest, that there's a racial tendency that, that we're inherently criminals, Indigenous people. And until we change that sort of, biases towards our people, it's going to be a difficult change. You know, like close the gap with those policies on trying to alleviate some of the issues around the incarceration and child removal of our children. It doesn't appear to be working, and then statistics are going in the opposite direction. And I think that's predominantly with the federal system, where states and territories are responsible for justice. That justice becomes a trump card when it comes election time in allowing tough on crime wins elections. And until somehow we can change that's going to be always the case in this country. You know, there's possibility that the federal government might need to have a look and get some legal advice on whether they can, through the constitution, try and undercut that at the moment. Because if we go have a look at what's happening now in the Close the Gap, states and territories are not adhering to their requirements that they've signed off on the Close the Gap policy. And so basically we have tough on crime everywhere. We have changing bail and sentencing. And basically we're not adhering to the requirements that they've said that they would adhere to.
You mentioned earlier one of the people you interviewed for the book was Gary Foley, an iconic rights advocate for our people, and I like to think a friend of the podcast. What did his voice add to your understanding, and what are your reflections? He did note the introduction for the book, wrote the foreword. No small thing to get that done. What did that mean to you?
Oh, well, as you know, Gary was there at the start, and, you know, to get him to come and to share his knowledge and that, it was really eye-opening for myself, someone who's even worked there, to really get that perception of an understanding of how they went about formalising the Aboriginal Legal Service in the first instance. And, you know, that was just a few of them coming together and realising the issues, hearing historical things that happened to lead up to them deciding whether to develop such a service. And, you know, the police bashings and heading to the US to meet the Black Panthers to have a look at the service delivery that they were doing. And then just, you know, little things like hearing how they heard about what was going on in the US around rights and getting information from, you know, Black Americans who were in Sydney for the on leave from the services and, you know, engaging with them and speaking about what's happening in the US and how they're combating it really gave Gary and others the foresight to go and look at delivering a similar service in Australia. And I think, you know, that really underpinned it. And he's, you know, really has been at the forefront for a while and really strong in regards to service delivery and that and around community control and looking at what actually is community control. And I think, you know, that those are the sort of questions that we now need to ask in the situations that we are in this country. And I really learned a whole heap from him just speaking about, you know, his participation in the rights movement in Australia.
Yes, he continues to be inspiring and an important voice after all these years, which is extraordinary. Now, I was one of your PhD supervisors and I remember how much conviction and intellectual curiosity you brought to that project and how the concept of self-determination was so central. And I wonder if you can share with us your reflections on how you've come to more deeply understand the importance of that principle and what it means in practice, having gone through both the process of the PhD and now the process of turning the PhD into a really important book.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of literature around self-determination and you know, the realities are, you know, we have the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People as a framework that we can all look to. Unfortunately, in Australia, we haven't really gone about trying to endorse that. And so there's a lot of, you know, people just trying to get on and do what they can in regards to what self-determination looks like to them. And, you know, like, for example, just speaking to those that work within the organisation and had, you know, there was a few who had been there 20 years plus and they themselves were questioning what self-determination looks like. And they, a lot of them said under the current structures that they were in, that the organisations, there's no self-determination insofar as that they're contractual service providers. And that might be true in a sense, but they can only really work to what they're allowed to do. Their services are so important, particularly with, you know, how many of our people are going through the justice system, whether it be jail or out of home care. You know, it's really required service, and so there needs to be ways around on trying to deliver and still work within our means of our communities, and a lot of them are trying to do that under those conditions I said before, and I you know, like in the writings and that I try to compare what with ATSIC and what some of our other Indigenous academics had said. And, you know, Arlene Morton Robinson said it was more about self-management rather than self-determination and whether we need to look at other ways of becoming self-determining. And I looked at other organisations, Indigenous organisations around the country who are trying to incorporate their, you know, cultural governance within their structures and allowing them to be so self-determining in a way that they meet the requirements of their communities. And so the unfortunate thing for the Aboriginal Legal Service is that they're so flat out in providing services with very limited scope of finances and people that they really can't pull up too much to really reassess their works on how they connect to country and to community. And that's something that I said in the research, that maybe they somehow need to do that, pull up and really work out how they still become legitimate to our communities in regards to service provision and whether they actually represent our communities or are they just really contracted service providers. And I mean, that's a question for them. I'm not questioning them that whether they are a service that we don't need, because that's something I will say straight up, that they're a real urgent service and are providing a good service. But, you know, our communities have also grown, and, you know, native titles allowed people to govern themselves in certain ways and who want to speak for their own communities. And so these are the things that we as peoples need to come to grips with and work out how we do that.
One of the exciting and important things about reshaping a thesis and the hard intellectual work that's in it into a book for a broader audience is, of course, the ideas reach, you know, many more people who can engage with them. What's your hope, Eddie, of what people will take away from reading the book?
I just hope that, you know, it's a real valued service. It's undervalued by governments. And I'm hoping the community, not so much Indigenous community, but the non-Indigenous community, can look from an Indigenous perspective on what the services actually do. They don't actually just deliver in court services. They do a whole heap outside, which we don't recognise. And, you know, it's the oldest Indigenous service in the country. It was even prior to legal aid commissions and that. So, you know, a lot of the, you know, ingenuitive things that they established, like, you know, court support officers who were once called field officers, you know, and it also, I don't think we talk much about it, but it encourages people like myself and that to go on and do further studies. It expedites non-Indigenous people's knowledges on Indigenous peoples, but also their legal careers. And, you know, then they go on to become judges and cases and what have yous. And that's good for, not only for our communities, but it's good for the whole profession in regards to trying to break down those barriers. And so I think, again, like I say, the legal services get a raw deal, but they provide so much of this hidden services and education that they're not recognised for. And so I'm hoping that the book does that, but I also hope it recognises the history of the ALS and the likes of Gary Foley and Dennis Egerton and others like that who have gone on and provided services in each state and territory. You know, like some of the dignitaries in my state, the Northern Territory, you know, like, you know, Priscilla Collins and Arnie Patmiller and so forth are recognised for the hard work that they've done over their journey and that the ALS is still running some 50, you know, 6 years after they established out of Redfern on a smell of an oily rag.
Eddie, you've talked about the challenges we face around closing the gap, particularly in the justice space. And your book's a really important contribution for us to understand the role that our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander legal services play in that ecology. But just with your experience, your depth of experience and understanding of the system, are there particular policy changes or systemic reforms that you think are both urgent and achievable in, say, the next 5 years? What would make a difference?
So I just resigned off JPP as a, you know, like a stand to say that the justice part in the Close the Gap is failing. And then I think, you know, I sort of touched on it that we need to accept that it's failing and because of the structure that it has, you know, states and territories use it to win elections, and tough on crime is that key card, right? And until states and territories can mature enough to accept that, you know, all the research that says tough on crime doesn't work, we're going to continually pour bad money into bad projects like locking people up. And, you know, again, I've got to say, and as you're aware, that the federal government's happy to use the race card for detrimental things for Indigenous people, but maybe it's time to try and look at how they could use that or other parts of the Constitution to really force states and territories to really act positively towards Indigenous peoples, because currently at the moment they're really not meeting any of the performance indicators of Close the Gap. And unless we're going to be serious about it, I think we're going to continually go down this road of failing. And it's Indigenous people who are suffering, and it's our organisations who continuously, you know, going about and get criticism for these failures, when in fact it's really not them. And I think until both state and federal governments are willing to sit down and really accept that they play a bigger role in this, and that their maturity needs to come forward if we're going to really change what's happening in the Indigenous space, whether it be in justice or in health or education. But I think that's where we're at the moment, Larissa. As you know, there's been a plethora of royal commissions, coronials, other research that's done right across, in whether it be education, housing, and we don't seem to follow through with what those recommendations are. We're spending big money on royal commissions and everywhere, and you know they're not being implemented. And so it's just a continuous failure of the systemic structures that we have at the moment. And I think unless we're willing to really look at them and break them down and start again, then I don't think we're going to have too much change in the next 5 years at all.
Just finally, Eddie, on a slightly different note, so much work, so much lived experience, so much sort of intellectual thinking has gone into the process that's led to the book. How did it feel when you actually had a physical copy in your hands?
The box turned up at my house and I didn't know what it was, and there was five copies in there, and I was really excited, and you know, I rang my kids, and yeah, just, you know, I come from Darwin and I had kids at 20, and I just never thought that I'd go to university, let alone write a book. So I was shocked. And then just the feedback I'm getting from people is really great. And I'm really trying to make it a community thing, because that's what the Aboriginal Legal Service is all about. And so I'm just really overawed that it's come to that, and I'm excited to have a copy on me right now, which I got one for you.
Oh, I'll look forward to having it, and hopefully a signed copy, Eddie.
No worries.
Well, congratulations on Defending the Defenceless. Thank you so much for being such an important continuing voice in our understanding of what true systemic change would mean. And thank you for your tireless advocacy in this space. Eddie Cabillo, it's always such a privilege to have you on Speaking Out.
Thank you, Larissa.
That was Professor Eddie Cabillo speaking about his book, Defending the Defenceless. It's a deeply personal insight into the complexities of being an Aboriginal man working in a justice system that has historically worked against us. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more stories from across Indigenous Australia. Speaking Out is produced by Janaya Gibbs-Muir. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our Titter Show Away, hosted by the wonderful Rudy Bremer. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.